TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. From the City of Quartz to San Francisco. Mike Davis in conversation with Tim Redmond. This program takes you back to the year 2000. It is part of TUC Radio's collection on the fate of California cities and the forces that shape them. On a rare, warm evening in San Francisco's rebellious Mission District, Los Angeles urban historian Mike Davis had come to help out with a very special benefit. Davis has since written over 20 books. However, in 2000, he was already widely known as author of Beyond Blade Runner, Urban Control, The Ecology of Fear, Prisoners of the American Dream, and City of Quartz, Excavating the Future in Los Angeles. Here's my introduction for the first and so far only broadcast. This conversation between Mike Davis and the editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, Tim Redmond, was recorded at a benefit for the San Francisco Anti-Eviction Coalition. A standing-room-only audience had come to see the man who had taught Los Angelinos to see their city with new eyes. In his book, City of Quartz, he recalls the citrus groves and cooperative farms of the turn of the century that were replaced with unregulated urban growth driven by a Blade Runner-style capitalism. Unearthing the forces that now shape cities, Davis says that Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other American cities might share a common future, and that we all might share a common strategy to protect the places we need and care for. Mike Davis had come to San Francisco at a very difficult time. A wave of gentrification had begun in 1997. An investment boom, driven by the nearby Silicon Valley computer industry, had already raised rents in San Francisco to the highest of any major American city. Official statistics reported 7 evictions per day. Countless others were never included. Small businesses, repair shops, mom-and-pop restaurants, and many Spanish-speaking families were forced out. At the same time, a vibrant grassroots movement emerged that uses direct action, political organizing, art, and music to oppose the pro-development policies of San Francisco's mayor and city administration. The evicted, soon to be evicted, and those who were determined never to be evicted made up the audience in the conversation you are about to hear. Here is Bay Guardian editor Tim Redmond asking the first question.
One of the great stories that I've heard, and I don't really know where it comes from, is a tale that when the first white settlers showed up in the Los Angeles Basin and started building settlements there, some Native American groups came down and the natives said to them, "You can't build a city here, folks, because there's no air and there's no water." Which seemed kind of simplistic at the time, I imagine, when the people who were just moving in there, but you know, in retrospect, it's a really brilliant analysis of what's wrong with LA. There's no air and there's no water. That's pretty much what's happened as we've built up a city there. If you look at the history of cities, Jane Jacobs has always kind of argued that great cities grow up organically, that they grow up because they're crossroads of civilization, because they happen to be at a place where trails are crossing, where there's a place where people can pull over in ships, and that they grow outward as people settle there and become organic centers of civil discourse. And if there's anything you can't say about LA, it's that it's organic. It's a lot of things, but it's certainly not organic. So how did the biggest city on the West Coast become the most screwed up and the one that's the least organic? How did we get where we are in LA?
Well, I don't know which part of your question to address first. Let's take the idea that there's no air, no water, because people in Los Angeles are so deeply alienated from their environment that probably most of us suspect that that's true. Beneath the artificial landscape and the lawns and the swimming pools, there's probably a remorseless desert just waiting to come back and, you know, gobble us up. But in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. Los Angeles's greatest mineral resource are millions of acre feet of prehistoric water in its water basins. Los Angeles is a classical Mediterranean country. The first Europeans to come to Southern California themselves were Mediterranean. In fact, they were all from Mallorca, the Franciscan fathers. They loved the place. By their standards, it was well-watered, oak savannas everywhere. It was a beautiful country. The Indians seemed to be prosperous, and they weren't too upset when there was an earthquake or a flood or two. Indeed, one of them speculated there were probably, you know, volcanoes nearby. The problem started when Anglo-Americans came to Southern California and imported into Southern California a whole series of landscape preconceptions and stereotypes that belonged to the kind of odd continuum of nature in northwestern Europe and northeastern United States. And there's nowhere on the surface of the earth where you can cross an ocean and find landscapes and flora as similar as northwestern Europe and northeastern United States. It's colder in the United States with bigger waterfalls and so on. But there's enough of a continuum here to support the idea that nature, when it changes, changes in little increments slowly. But all that falls apart when you come to a semi-arid environment or a classic Mediterranean landscape, because nothing here happens slowly in increments. Change tends to be concentrated in big events, extreme events, which we've socially constructed as disasters. Nothing is ever the norm or the average. Okay, nothing is rarer in Southern California than average, you know, rainfall. We're either in a drought or we're in a, you know, a humid period. And Anglo-Americans have always had incredible difficulty dealing with a landscape that defies its stereotypes, one that's fundamentally nonlinear, as I argue in, you know, my book, kind of Walden Pond on LSD. This is Big Bang country. And this has led to the imposition of ideas and expectations about the landscape that just don't work. Okay? Either it has to be the land of perfect sunshine, or it's an apocalypse theme park.
Let's go back. I mean, go back 100 years. And suppose there was some kind of vision of progressive ecological urban planning in the LA basin 100 years ago. And suppose you were in charge. What would we do differently?
Well, as I try and point out in the book, there have been in every generation powerful, coherent visions of what we should have done. If you go back 100 years ago, of course, Southern California was a society capitalized on racism and, you know, and exploitation with an agricultural system that wasn't that different from the deep, you know, South. It depended on coercion and, you know, and total segregation. It was a city at war with its unions. But setting all the bad stuff aside for a second, on the other hand, it was a spectacular middle-class civilization. You know, of garden cities was the first entirely electrified urban region in the United States, the first place where you had agricultural towns, which weren't simply, you know, backwaters, but were modern progressive centers of learning and industry. Citrus was really the high-tech industry at the turn of the century, with all kinds of related branches, including hydroelectric power, which was first produced on a large scale, believe it or not, in Southern California. And the key thing is that you had the city set in this matrix of endless orchards and farmlands. And as the city began to develop and literally explode with growth in the early 20th century, you had one famous planner or urban designer after another come to Los Angeles and basically say this the same thing. You have to regulate the market forces that will tear this apart, which will develop all the open space. And the key to any kind of environmental planning, and really also the key eventually to social justice, is to preserve open space as a constraint on development in order to use it to, you know, shape the city. So cities had three or four generations of really brilliant plans for green belts. Los Angeles is the site of one of the most ambitious, in some ways, beautiful New Deal city planning experiments. But they've always been defeated. And the question that needs to be asked is not why Los Angeles isn't my socialist utopia or your, you know, green utopia, but just contrast Los Angeles with the other cities of the Pacific Slope, where I realize there's also sprawl and congestion in Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco, but in each of these cities, as well as Vancouver, regional environmental movements have won striking victories. You preserve the Bay, you preserve the Bay Area Hills. Portland's world famous for controlling growth on its fringes and so on. And you have to ask the question, what makes Los Angeles so exceptional in this regard that it has none of these signal environmental victories? And in fact, it has an environmental movement which has never really been regional in scale. It tends to be entirely focused on questions of the Santa Monica Mountains and the Santa Monica Bay. As important as they are the amenities that support luxury lifestyles on the west side, which is why they draw the energy and support. But there's nothing equivalent for the kind of people for open space movement you've had in the Bay Area. So that's an interesting historical question to ask.
Why do you think that is? What's different about it?
For a Marxist, I'm going to give you a very peculiar answer. I mean, one reason, of course, is the American labor movement has never had a politics of urban form or urban design. It's never had an environmental politics. It's never tried to shape cities in a way that makes them more sustainable and simultaneously more just. It simply abdicated the question in favor of alliances with whatever huge growth strategy it is, tearing poor people's neighborhoods down to build more high-rises. But probably the really deepest difference between LA and anywhere else is we don't have a ruling class that particularly likes its environment. In San Francisco, you have this ancient Nob Hill elite, which had flocked to hear John Muir in the 1880s and 1890s, you know, original chartered members of the Sierra Club, want to ensure their view from Pacific Heights is never despoiled. So you've had elite environmentalists, and likewise in all the other cities of the Pacific Slope. In L.A., there was a kind of stratum like this, a kind of stratum that hallucinated itself living the lifestyle of imaginary Spanish dons in an ancient feudal California. But they all moved up to Montecito and Santa Barbara, where this charade has continued, you know, today. L.A. has always been the kind of ultimate republic of realtors and developers. And this is usually literally true on its growth edges. Until last year, for instance, in the Antelope Valley, or what is now more politely called North L.A. County, I don't want to acknowledge that this is actually part of the Mojave Desert, the two high-growth cities of Palmdale and Lancaster, every single member of both their city councils was a realtor. L.A. County supervisors, who are the most powerful local officials in the United States, if not in the world, with constituencies of almost 2 million residents, making them larger than the vast majority of American senators, receive anywhere from 75% to 90% of their campaign contributions from developers. So there's not really a city in the country where you find quite the same continuous, untrammeled rule of real estate and development capital. In L.A., people will say, oh, you know, the Chandlers did newspapers. Wrong. The Chandlers did real estate, and newspapers were a sideline to that. Or somebody else did steel. Wrong. That was a sideline to doing real estate. Real estate's always been the basic constituent activity of Los Angeles elites.
You know, if you talk to the boosters in L.A., and actually in a lot of places in California, they'll say, but what we're facing now is we're victims of our own success. This is such a wonderful state, such a beautiful place to live, that everybody wants to move here. And that's why there's 35 million Californians, and we have all of these problems of growth. And, you know, it's because it's such a great place and such a wonderful environment. And I think if you look back, a lot of that is real estate developer hype. A lot of that is people who were building tract houses around L.A., putting out the word that this is a great place to come to so that they could sell those houses. But now we got 35 million people, and it looks like there'll probably be 40 or 45 million in the next 10 or 15 years. How did this happen? And what, I mean, since we're here now, what are we going to do about it?
Well, first of all, let me say I had Ted Turner's TV crew show up a couple of years ago, and they were making some sinister program in a bunch of installments about overpopulation. And what they were interested in was Southern California flooded by by immigrants, bursting at its seams, the environment degraded, people crammed into. So I suggested to them that since they had a lot of money, they rent a helicopter and simply overfly the Coachella Valley. This is the region east of Los Angeles, where Palm Springs is. And on one side of the valley, you find hardworking Chicano Mexican farm worker communities with barely, they're lucky, an acre of park space. On the other side of the valley, you find 99 golf courses in a row and thousands of white guys my age sitting around in golf carts. And the question is, who's using up the state's resources? Whose labor, sustains the state? The definitive work, I think, by the way, in terms of the arguments against a Malthusian view of California, is this brilliant book that appeared about 8 years ago by David Hayes Batista and two other Chicano demographers called The Burden of Support. And it showed that the real world is exactly the inverse of Pete Wilson's the world that he's portrayed for the last 10 years, where a growing labor force of young Latinos and people of color, will be struggling more with more and more desperation to try and support the claims of unproductive, retired, old white guys, like me, in a state that's no longer making the same kinds of investment in social infrastructure and education. I mean, the thing is about California, I'm sure for any strict environmentalist, we're always overpopulated. We were probably overpopulated for deep ecologists in the 1850s. They'd like to see just a thin sprinkling of hunter-gatherers across the high-tech hunter-gatherers across the landscape. But where we've left the rails, of course, is that we've managed in the last decade to destroy the growth machinery that made California the most advanced science-based economy in the whole world. And if you want to put that into almost into a cliche, what that was, it was just the odd fact that in 20th century California, a very strong state labor movement and a very strong middle-class progressive movement with a big P, like Teddy Roosevelt's progressive movement, could agree on only one thing. And only one thing alone. And this was one area where their interests converged. This was high spending for education. And we built the finest education system in the world. And we were at one point even poised to be the first society in the history of the world to make 14 years of minimum education. This was the master plan back in the 1960s. And what it meant for people like me, whose parents hitchhiked out here during the Depression, is that regardless of that background, white kids in the 1960s could look forward to, an economy that was flush with all kinds of traditional high-wage jobs and the almost limitless opportunities of an education system that was free at every level. Now, when I teach at places like the Cesar Chavez Center at UCLA, and I look into faces of the smartest, just most wonderful undergraduates I've ever seen, I have to tell them, look, your future is looted in advance. Or maybe particularly the future for your younger brothers and sisters, or your friends who aren't here at UCLA in the post, 209 period. Everything's changed. That cornucopia of jobs doesn't exist. Those educational opportunities don't exist. And they don't exist because of some harsh Darwinian dictator, the tyranny of the world economy. They don't exist because we've systematically and consciously dismantled it in the last 10 or 15 years at exactly the time when we should be increasing the level of investment and labor force. And I'm talking here just in terms of capitalist rationality, nothing even to do with social justice. We've done the opposite and, in a sense, killed the golden goose. The big difference in the political cultures of Southern and Northern California is, to some extent, that's grasped up here. You even have Silicon Valley billionaires, who understand the idea of industrial sobriety, who have some inkling, some theory of the history of California. In Southern California, you have just sheer idiocy. And stupidity. But I mean this in seriously, that somehow you're freeing the animal spirits of capitalism by destroying the social investments that built California into what it was. And nothing, of course, is more emblematic of that. Nothing is a more malign symptom than the decision over the last decade to spend more money on prisons than on our state universities. And what's kind of interesting is states whose model has been California. Like, go to North Carolina. North Carolina is a smart southern state where everybody sat around for a generation trying to figure out how to be California. Okay? And because of that, they kind of have a theory of California. They don't spend money wildly on prisons. They have something, for instance, called the matrix sentencing system that adjusts the supply of prisoners to the availability of prison cells. They're not about to be driven blindly into you know, overbuilding prisons. And again, it has nothing to do with social justice or the milk of human kindness. It's just competitive economics. But they understand it. And in Southern California, there's not a glimmering of this understanding. I mean, the society in some ways committing suicide, killing the gold, you know, the golden goose, and trumpeting that it's simply freeing the spirits of the marketplace.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. It wasn't always this way. I mean, California was once a very progressive state. You know, 1934, Upton Sinclair runs for governor as the Democratic candidate with what's probably the most serious socialist reform program that any major candidate for governor in any major states had in a long, long time. Came out of Southern California, came out of the LA area. The state of California for a long time was kind of where a lot of progressive ideas came from. I mean, even when I moved out here in 1980, Jerry Brown was governor, and at least Jerry Brown was Jerry Brown. I mean, he wasn't Upton Sinclair, but at least he was Jerry Brown. What's happened to California in the last 10 or 15 years? And what is it going to take to make this a progressive state again? I mean, you've got a room full of people here who would like to walk out of here tonight and say, what do we do to go back to those days and to make this a progressive state again?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, I mean, the absolutely obvious point is that everywhere, suburbanization and the growth and shift of power to edge cities, not just from traditional center cities, but from older suburbs as well, has weakened the integuments of, you know, traditional progressive politics. But the second thing is all this has happened on the watch of the Democrats. I mean, the easiest game you can play in California is to blame the Republicans for everything. Everything's Pete Wilson's fault. It was Duke Majan's fault. I don't think that's the case. If you want to look for the profiles in moral cowardice, you look at the Democrats. The Democrats have dominated the legislature for most of our lifetimes, and they've done it with a kind of complicity, which, particularly in the Willie Brown years, would take the form of, Pete Wilson says he wants to gas the Jews. They interview, you know, Willie Brown. Willie Brown says, oh, this is horrible. This is unspeakable. You know, this is genocidal. Why don't we gas half the Jews? I mean, that's exactly, forgive me for this example, but I mean this seriously. This is a common currency of politics in Sacramento, is the Democrats can always prostrate themselves lower, you know, than any Republican, and they have. And it's particularly startling when Willie Brown, like him or not, is by all accounts probably one of the most brilliant politicians we've had in 20th century California, but without a shred of moral background. I remember when he came down to this isn't a San Francisco Renaissance. I say, okay. Came down to California for this law enforcement summit about 5 years ago, and all the press was chortling how brave Willie was to come in the lion's den with Pete Wilson and all the police chiefs. And he was talking to a few of his press cronies, and they were asking him about Prop 184, three strikes. And he said, this is a disaster for California. It'll bankrupt California. And they said, what are you going to do about it? He said, nothing. I'm going to facilitate its passage through the legislature. You know, you get killed trying to oppose it. I mean, when's the last time any of us have actually seen a Democrat fall on their sword for the sake of principle? But having said that, California politics are become very interesting in the last 5 or 6 years. For one thing, you know, the Bay Area has emerged on a national scale for whatever series of reasons. It's just overwhelmingly the most progressive political constituency in the United States, and not just San Francisco County or Alameda County. You know, stands far, far apart. And of course, one of the ingredients here, which really doesn't exist on the same scale anywhere else, it's one of the few places in the United States where you have white men who are progressives, you know, particularly gay men. It's a huge, you know, political difference. But Southern California just, you know, isn't the darkness of Orange County. In fact, Orange County isn't even still immersed in darkness. Northern Orange County is an increasingly blue-collar and Latino county, and you have this great sleeping dragon of Latino politics beginning to wake up in Southern California. And the big question is, the question that's really the future of California, is what direction will it take? What will it mean? And having had the honor of teaching for 3 or 4 years at UCLA in this Cesar Chavez Center, or is he just the extraordinary kids who are going to be the new civic intelligentsia of Southern California, the one common denominator, consistent thing, is just their total disillusionment with existing Latino Democratic leadership. Moral zero in California political history had to be, when was it, when Wilson and Cruz Bustamante got into the following conversation. Wilson said, we're going to have to get to the point where we can take 15-year-old mad dogs and execute them as adults. Cruz Bustamante said, although it would hurt me, I mean, it would really grieve me to say this, but there are probably occasions when we should do that to 14-year-olds as well. This is in a political culture where you can't even talk about employment issues or full employment anymore, but you can talk about executing 14-year-olds. So I think there are, you know, enormous reservoirs of progressive political energy in this state. But to find real expression, I mean, we're basically going to have to shoot the entire present generation.
Even though we don't believe in the death penalty, but sometimes or, summary execution. Right?
You know, or do what, you know, what folks in New Mexico have done, which is build a really credible third party out of the Latino and parts of the Latino and labor wing of the Democratic Party and out of the Green Party. If there's ever to be a hope that Democrats begin to act even faintly like liberals again, it's only because there's a third party, you know, breathing down their neck. I mean, the advantage of a third party getting to the threshold where, say, it can command 5-10% of the vote would mean that for the, you know, the first time in a generation, the pressures on the Democratic Party are coming from the left and not from the right.
That was the urban historian and acclaimed author Mike Davis, interviewed by Tim Redmond, now editor and publisher of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. This is a TUC radio archival program from the year 2000 that I recorded at a benefit for the San Francisco Anti-Eviction Coalition. As a young man, Mike Davis worked as a meat cutter and truck driver. He's now, in 2013, professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. Among the over 20 books he has written are The Grit Beneath the Glitter, Tales from the Real Las Vegas, and Fighting Racism and State Violence on the U.S.-Mexico Border. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. You can get a CD of the interview with Mike Davis on the website or by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website or by mail keeps this program on the air. Call 707-463-2654 or go to tucradio.org for the mailing address and donate buttons. On tucradio.org, you can also subscribe to weekly podcasts. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.